ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
There was a chook who was left something like £10 million in a will. She was called Jiju, but she was rich, so maybe posh, like Jiju. Anyway, does that mean I can leave my car to my cat or my daddo to my dog? What the Duck is presenting Nature's Most Wanted, the intersection of animals and the law. You know, pigs being tried for murder or ducks getting speeding tickets. What the Duck on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello there, welcome once more to The Minefield as we try to negotiate the ethical and moral dilemmas of modern life and sometimes find solutions to the insoluble. Although I have to say, not sure that's ever worked. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens is my co-host. Hello, Scott.
Hey, Waleed. I've got a question for you.
Oh, okay.
Because you revealed something, was it late last year, that I never, ever, ever knew about you. I didn't realize that you were a bit of a South Park frequenter, aficionado. I still have the sound of you doing a Cartman.
Okay, hang on.
It's like a splinter in the back of my mind.
Aficionado is not the right word.
You've watched it a bit.
Well,
you know enough.
Not for close to 30 years.
Okay,
now.
Okay.
But I would have been at university when it first came out.
Gosh.
And I ended up many years later about a totally different thing, interviewing Trey Parker and Matt Stone. And I told them that, and they said, oh, that would have hit you right between the eyes. It's like, yeah, that's the age at which that hits you right between the eyes. All right, so I was the right age at the right time.
That's so funny. So here's my question.
Yeah.
I vaguely remember this gag on a particular episode where if one of Cartman's friends, if Kenny and Kyle,
yep,
if they begin singing the first line of a song, is it a sting? Yes. Is it a sting song?
I can't remember.
What is
now,
it?
But yes,
Cartman has to finish
the whole thing. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. 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 And so they just keep saying it.
So my son was watching this the other day, and it's just, I mean, it's a very, very, very funny joke. So I was hoping you're going to help me out with the name of the song, so I didn't sound like a complete buffoon. But that particular,
I'll figure it out.
Ship has passed. So here's why I raise it. There's a loose thread that's been dangling ever since we did our last show of last year.
This is the most bizarre way to get to this.
It's like someone has just begun the first line of whatever that song that Cartman then has to compulsively finish.
I think it's Come Sail Away.
I think that's right.
I say that because I've just Googled it.
Okay, there you go. So there's this dangling thread, and it's been bugging me ever since. And it's also bugging me not just because I'm a perfectionist at heart, although I, quite possibly am. It's not just because I don't like things being sort of neat and tidy, although, to be perfectly honest, I do kind of. It's also because this particular issue, I think, is actually morally and democratically incredibly significant. So do you just want me to sort of lay out the...
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Glad you asked. So you remember that the last show that we did, at the end of last year, before we embarked on our best of summer series, was looking at the series of 14th century murals painted by Ambrogio Lorenzetti in Siena, laying out, it's widely known as the allegories of good and bad government.
Yeah.
It's moral philosophy and political philosophy in visual form. So there's this one scene, there's this one element in Ambrogio Lorenzetti's central mural, the allegory of good government. You'll remember the dominant figure on the left side of the mural is the figure of Justitia, of justice. And she has on either side of her the scales that are balancing. And she has her thumb on either side of the scales. One scale represents reward. The other scale represents punishment, presumably reward to those to whom it's warranted, and the other side, punishment to those upon whom it's merited.
Yeah.
But then what's staggering about the mural is that coming from each side of the scale is a red thread and a white thread. The white on the side of the reward, the red on the side of punishment, somewhat appropriately. Yeah. But then, through the mediating figure of Concordia, of Concord, these threads are bound together into an alternating red and white cord that then passes through the hands of Concordia and then through the hands of 24 Sienese citizens that are lined up along the bottom of the mural. This thread of concord, this rope, sorry, of concord runs through their hands and then out the other side and then forms the ruling staff whereby the common good presides over the well-being of the city as a whole.
Yeah.
I find it an amazing image that represents in visual form the degree to which not just justice, but also our confidence in the conditions of and in the execution, the administration of justice, the way that the administration of justice and our confidence in the administration of justice holds together the conditions within which we can trust one another, look at one another not as some who benefit from ideal conditions and others who are at their detriment, but rather we can look at one another as those who share a stake in the conditions of our common life, who operate under the same moral conditions, who therefore can operate in a manner that is both trusting and trustworthy. And it's by that, it's by the conditions created by the administration of justice that something like the possibility of concord, maybe in times like us, or if Ambrogio Lorenzetti was painting today, he would have named the central figure social cohesion. It doesn't quite work. It doesn't quite work, but it almost...
There's so much about this, it's funny, because it's like, the lengths you've gone through to get to the topic of social cohesion is admirable.
Come on. South Park, 14th century Italian Renaissance art. Where else are you going to get that?
It's one of the great journeys in the history of the show. But that this, such a fine piece could culminate in something as, I don't know, managerial?
No.
Oh, come on.
No.
The language of social cohesion.
Okay. I mean, that's just, those aren't the right words.
But that's what's funny, is that the culmination was in this thing. Yeah. And maybe my laughter betrays a certain attitude because
is it weariness?
Could be. Maybe weariness. It is weary. Not of the example, by the way, and not of your excursions, but of the invocation of social cohesion and of it as a touchstone. It feels a bit to me like it's become, well, there are a lot of things it's become, we'll probably get into it in the show, but it's almost become a term without meaning, where what it is probably getting more to is just a feeling of not being uncomfortable with what's going on out there. Mm-hmm. And it has less to do with cohesion in society and more to do with just comfort within oneself. And so I can't hear the language as anything other than some kind of political talking point at the moment. I know that's not necessarily fair.
No.
And there was a time where I wouldn't have felt that.
I know that.
But there is something about the way in which its preponderance in the last few years that it just strikes me that way. So the idea of this Renaissance masterpiece culminating in this talking point, sorry, I just found it irresistibly funny.
Well, I mean, the whole reason that I raise it is just how much this ideal of Concordia, and it really is an ideal. I mean, Ambrogio Lorenzetti does his best to individuate each of the 24 members of this collection of citizens that runs along the bottom. And there is some, let's call it, diversity. There are some that are heavier than others. There are some who are, let's call it, swarthier than others, even if there's no overt representation of different religions or different races. There is at least an attempt, even if it's not necessarily a good faith attempt. There's something there that says these citizens don't just naturally cohere because of what they sort of instinctively or naturally or immediately or viscerally have in common. But I think the interesting thing for me is just how taut, how tight, how perfectly balanced the scales of justice need to be in order for this cord, this red and white cord that represents Concordia, just how taut and finely tuned the scales of justice need to be. Which means, and Millicent Churcher, our guest in last week's show, she signaled this at the end of the near the end of the program, that when something happens and the conditions of trust begin to break down, our suspicion, our belief, our hope that we are being treated fairly, that some aren't being granted preferential treatment, that justice is in fact being ministered in a manner that is inviting to all. In other words, that the conditions of trust is something that can be relied upon to be to everyone's benefit. When that begins to break down, when the language of of Concord begins to turn to sawdust in your mouth when it elicits a laugh, when it seems more bureaucratic than substantive, or even when it simply becomes a means of state and federal governments to get something that they otherwise want, when there's that level of suspicion, we then reach the point where the very hope for Concord, the hope of something that might bind us together, or the hope of a capacity, you know, you would have to say that even though these 24 citizens at the bottom of Lorenzetti's mural are standing together, they're a couple that are speaking together, they're not really deliberating together, but you would hope that the way that Concord manifests itself is in the ability of some to speak to others, knowing that their words are not going to be injurious, that their meaning is going to be, again, delicately balanced and is going to be received in good faith. That, it seems to me, those are the conditions that I fear, I worry, have not entirely, but have gone a long way towards breaking down. It's worth saying that when we recorded that episode about Lorenzetti's murals, it was before Bondi.
Yeah, that's true.
It was before everything that's happened since. It was before the passage of hate speech legislation. It was before certain states have banned certain slogans, certain statements at protest rallies. It was before the calling of a royal commission. My concern, Waleed...
Sorry, and before the expansion of police force.
Thank you.
Yeah.
My concern is that we are currently marinating in distrust, in mistrust.
This is a lovely framing. And I'm really glad you began not so much with the South Park thing, but but with Renaissance paintings. And I think, by the way, I think you might have said Millicent Churchill was on the show last week.
I meant last year.
But I don't want to begin with trust, actually. I think the power of the way you've framed this and of invoking Lorenzetti is that it begins with justice.
That's right.
And that has, just in that instance, it's helped me think of the social cohesion issue in a different way. That one of the reasons we feel so frayed at the moment is not just that there isn't a belief in justice being done, but that I think there are now completely opposite conceptions at play of what justice would even look like. So take the question of protest and the regulation or non-regulation of them. What would the just approach there be? If someone gets up and says a particular thing that then there's an argument about it falling foul of hate speech laws and so on and so forth. Well, if there is a huge section of society, or you don't even need the word huge, if there's a significant enough section of society for whom any declaration, however reached, however soberly deliberated upon, however well reasoned from a legal perspective, any verdict that wants to make it verboten, it becomes manifestly unjust. Then suddenly you have, like in a stroke, you've gotten rid of the value of things like natural justice and like procedural justice and all these. You don't feel that served because you feel like these things are merely just mechanisms for your continued immiseration.
Yeah, sorry,
and the flip side is true as well, right? Mm. If there is no means by which these sorts of statements can be reined in or whatever it might be, that the protest might be stopped or whatever. I don't mean to fixate on protests. I'm just using it as a...
No, but this is an important example.
Mm. Well, it's the most concrete one I can think of in this instance. If that's your position, then no sober administration of justice that falls on the side against which you're arguing will be perceived as justice. In other words, these things become the fallout of the zero-sum logic that has dominated in the case of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the war in Gaza, that has certainly is driving one particular area of social incohesion, shall we call it. In that case, that whole conflict is so zero-sum and in an odd way, we're so oddly tribalized, that the possibility of a common conception of what justice looks like there has filtered all the way down into how we respond to that. But you don't actually have to stop there, do you? I mean, any kind of incommensurability that we perceive as existing in society. And I think that's what we're trying to get at when we talk about social cohesion. I don't think we're actually after solid agreement. I think we're talking about an agreement that doesn't, or a disagreement that doesn't tip over into incommensurability.
That's right.
Where there is just
exactly
no
right.
way of even proceeding together. Mm. There's no common touchstone, there's no common language, etc. If you've reached a point where that means that there's no common conception of justice, then it's not even about justice being done. Because the doing of justice becomes a mechanism of injustice in the eyes of someone. And at that point, I worry that you've got Humpty Dumpty. Because by what conception of justice can you put all this back together again?
Well, I mean, this is where I do think the issue of trust is germane to the issue. So take the protest example.
Yeah.
And actually, let's not do the Israel-Gaza protests. Let's do Australia Day protests. Something that I'll confess, Waleed, I just do not understand.
Which ones are you talking about there? The Invasion Day ones or the Marches for Australia ones?
Both.
Right, okay.
So something that I don't understand morally. This makes no sense to me. For those who view January 26th as an occasion of mourning, of grieving, of marking and lamenting the dead, of mourning and grieving dispossession, for those to say, to those who regard January 26th as an occasion for celebration, for all manner of frivolity, of beach going, of barbecues, and so on. For those who insist on January 26th as a day for a celebration or as a day for protest against multiculturalism, to look with disdain on those who protest the use of that day as an occasion for celebration, when for them it is so manifestly an occasion for mourning. The very fact that there is a large segment of the population, and you would even want to say a segment of the population that enjoys a degree of moral primacy within the conditions of our common life, the very fact that there's some who are mourning, does it not make sense along any axis that registers the claims of democratic morality? Doesn't it in some extent spoil or prohibit our ability to simply lean into the celebration, to know that some are mourning? Doesn't that do something fundamental to one's own ability to celebrate? The incomprehension, the contemptuousness in response that, well, don't rain on my parade. You do you, let me do me. It makes no sense to me. Along precisely the same lines, Waleed, something that I think only takes place when there's been such a breakdown of trust where effectively one side cannot believe that the other side's grieving is legitimate or heartfelt or bone deep. In exactly the same way.
I think it's a bit different, actually.
Okay, but hang on. In exactly the same way, for me, morally speaking, I don't understand why some, driven by an astonishing sense of both grief, of loss, and motivated by an underlying moral seriousness over the destruction of and loss of life in Gaza. Why those demonstrating for that wish to use phrases that sound so offensive in, that sound so callous to, those on the other side of this particular debate. I do not understand the insistence on the use of intifada. I do not understand the insistence on the use of from the river to the sea. When it seems to me that neither is, for want of a better term, is necessary or integral to one's ability to register one's moral desperation, one's moral passion over the particular issue at case. The only way one side can be willing to continue to insist on their usage is if, A, they do not believe that the concerns on the other side are, that concerns the expression of soul injury, let's call it, is legitimate, is heartfelt, is sincere, or if they believe B, that the mere attempt to ban such phrases is just a ruse, is a morally high-minded mechanism for squashing any criticism of the state of Israel.
So you're saying that's your trust issue?
In both cases, we have one side looking at the other side with, you may say this, but I fundamentally do not believe that the words that you use, that the pain that you register, that the desperation that you feel is sincere. I fundamentally believe that it is motivated by something high-handed, by something heavy-handed, by a kind of moral disingenuousness. I fundamentally do not believe that what you are saying carries the moral weight that you want it to. And look, there are also those who protest, who disagree with the mere fact of pro-Gaza protests, who believe that these are just ruses, that these are morally inconsistent opportunities to vent expressions of anti-Semitic hatred that would otherwise be, and that should in fact be, banned everywhere. When you reach that level, I think, of mistrust, where one person's expression of moral desperation is another person's act of moral disingenuousness, that, I think, is where the conditions of justice then keep rotting and decaying, where we cannot help but then believe that justice itself is only favoring one side or the other.
Yeah, maybe that's true. So maybe our difference is one of language, or maybe we're putting carts before horses in different ways. I'd have to think about that. All I would say is there is another way to characterize what you're finding so bewildering and confounding there. And that is that one finds the claim of the other to be intrinsically injurious.
That's true.
So in the case of the, I don't even know how we describe them anymore, but the cases of the Marches for Australia or whatever, while there is obvious heartfelt pain about Australia Day and about January 26 and what it symbolizes and so on, well, my sense of it is it flows from a feeling of years of being morally condemned.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, I no longer see your heartfelt plea as a mere heartfelt plea. I see it as a relentless attack on my very fiber.
Mm.
Once I conclude that...
like the possibilities of political belonging?
Yeah, it could be. Even just the idea that I feel proud of the achievements of my nation, whatever. I mean, you can frame it in all sorts of ways, and there'll be good framings and bad ones. Okay. I don't want to get hung up on it. But the point is, whatever it is, this is something that I feel is really important to me. And the way you're approaching this renders it illegitimate ab initio and leaves me nowhere to go in your imagination other than some kind of moral damnation.
Mm.
At that point, I decide I just reject your claim.
Hmm.
And you can say you're hurt. We're all hurt. I'm hurt. I hurt is not relevant now. What's relevant is I'm standing for what I care about. Now, is that a breakdown of trust? Maybe. Yes, so you could certainly frame it that way. But all I'm observing is that in those conditions, the argument about what would constitute justice is insoluble. Or in the case of the Gaza protests, I mean, you would know all the arguments. You would be in the thick of it with a lot of the editing work that you're having to do, so I don't need to rehearse them. But the idea that your objection to this proceeds from a position of such domination, and it proceeds from a position of such dehumanization and erasure, and whatever language you want to put around it, but you know the concepts I'm getting at, that I regard it as either illegitimate ab initio, whether it's sincerely held or not, or I regard it as in itself an act of, well, I'm trying to avoid saying war, but you know what I mean.
Oppression.
Hmm. Yeah, let's say that. And so at that point, I don't need to get to the point of calling you insincere.
Yeah.
I just need to get to the point of saying, no, what you're insisting upon is itself an injustice or an injury, which I refuse to accept. And so I'm now couching this as a form of resistance. And as I couch it as a form of resistance, your feelings on the matter become entirely redundant.
Mm. Mm.
you know, we formulate it that way, I think that takes us back to then this problem of, well, then you have no common conception of justice that you can really even pursue. And any application of justice becomes unjust, or unjust, sorry. It becomes injustice in someone's eyes. Mm. Maybe we've just described the problem here. It's just the reason I'm doing this, and maybe I'm doing it too much, but the reason I'm doing this is I'd not thought of it this way until you led me there via Lorenzetti.
Mm.
But it's a fascinating way to think about it, particularly when you then come to think about the concept of, or the consequences of trying to restore or enforce social cohesion. Because if that is coming from the mouth of governments and via the application of state force, well, all that can do is shatter social cohesion.
That's exactly right. It's actually, it's coming from the side of the ruler in Lorenzetti's painting rather than from justice.
Right.
Yeah, that's right.
That you don't even need to go so far as get into an argument about whether you agree or disagree with the policies or whatever. All I'm saying is it can only be uncohesive, discohesioning, whatever.
I don't care if it's a word or not, it's going to stick. Discohesioning.
But you get my point. It can only be counterproductive.
Yeah.
Because the mechanism that's delivering it arrives with force into an environment where there is no common conception of justice anyway. Yep.
There you go. That's actually really helpful. That's really helpful, William.
I'd never even thought about this. And so thank you for your help in this. What a strange moment in the minefield this is. You are listening to The Minefield on ABC Radio National, where we try to negotiate the ethical and moral dilemmas of modern life. Well, there, darlings, my name is Scott Stephens, is my co-host. Now we have a guest. Hello.
Our guest is Ron Levy. He's professor in the College of Law, Governance and Policy at Australian National University. He's also a specialist in the conduct of citizens' assemblies. Now, Ron, first of all, hello. Welcome to The Minefield.
Good to be with you.
So if there is something that has begun to go wrong in the conditions of democratic or public life, and if our mechanisms of speaking to one another, of holding one another mutually accountable, if our mechanisms of speaking and deliberating rather than simply polemicizing or claiming, if those have begun to break down at the level of the public, is there something about the disciplines, the possibilities that are inherent to the practice of citizens' assemblies that could reboot, that could restart, that could help us reawaken something of those skills, those capacities for mutual trust that maybe we've neglected to our great detriment?
I think so. So, you know, I've been listening to you both talking in rather pessimistic terms. You've used words like rotting and decaying and, you know, Humpty Dumpty and so on. I don't think I'm quite as pessimistic. I think I'm a little bit optimistic, and I think the reason for that is that whether we trust each other and can overcome the sort of gaps in our knowledge of each other and the sort of moral gaps between, you know, understanding the other, depends on, you know, how we're doing it, how we are talking. So if you put antagonists in a room together and say, just talk it out, they will do so, but they'll do it in a very toxic way. So they won't talk in a good way. They'll do what we see at the protests and the counter-protests, and they'll yell at each other, and they won't be advancing any sort of common understanding. And so they'll stay incommensurable, to use Waleed's term. But we have many examples of putting people in a room together under more deliberative conditions, where people are able to deliberate in an effective way. So just to explain what a citizens' assembly is, it's a randomly selected group of people who are demographically representative of the broader population. And they're brought together into a room, much like a jury from a criminal case or a civil case, for example. And they learn at length from experts, you know, with diverse points of view. And then they, under facilitated conditions, discuss, you know, some recommended outcomes. So what, for example, should be the approach of a government in addressing social cohesion or what have you. And, you know, time and again, what we find is that, first of all, you've selected people who are not going into it as partisans. So this is just a rough estimate. I don't know the exact facts, but, you know, while we have people yelling at each other from the extremes, probably 70 to 80% of the Australian population is much more reasonable and open to agreeing with, you know, others. And so that huge population is also among us. And those people have not lost trust. Maybe after Bondi, maybe after everything that's happened since then, maybe there's been a decline of trust. But actually, Australia is a reasonably high trust society. It's one of the highest. Even trust in government is, you know, it's higher than in other countries. So you can draw on ordinary people, put them in a room together, facilitate their discussions with each other, and almost every time they reach, you know, majority view that's quite amicable, sometimes even something close to consensus. And, you know, some of the cases here are really particularly notable because this has been done among students in Israel and Palestine. It's been done in Ireland among abortion rights proponents and opponents. They might not end up being, you know, 100% on board with each other. They might actually even stay incommensurable in their views, but they can agree to disagree on respectful terms. And I think that's the bare minimum of social cohesion that we need. You know, that's the good kind of social cohesion where we're not expecting everyone to assimilate to each other's views, but instead we're just respecting each other and we're engaging in respectful dialogue and we're respecting each other's ways and so on. So this is all just by way of saying that a citizens assembly shows that it's within us or within many of us to agree with each other and to be harmonious and everything that we're looking for. The question is how to scale that up to the broader society, and that's something that we might need a multi-pronged approach for. So the use of the criminal law is very controversial. I wonder if maybe I disagree with both of you a little bit. I think that in some cases it might be acceptable. You've got to tread very, very carefully, but in the extreme case, there might be a fear that a particular vulnerable group might be targeted by people to such a degree that their safety and their sort of humanity might be targeted. And maybe in those cases, it's acceptable to throw a punishment at the people who are doing the targeting. Just to be like a last line of defense for the many diverse groups that we have in Australia. If we want to maintain our multicultural society, minority groups might feel to some extent like that protection is important, that we know that you can't say things that are exceptionally hateful. But for the most part, you can use other tools besides the criminal law. You can use civil penalties, or you can do more kind of nurturing things, positive things rather than penalties. Or you can do something in between, like, for example, better internet regulation. And I think that's actually a really important one. I think much of the problem that we've encountered is due to social media and the free-for-all on places like Twitter. So, you know, when I was last on Twitter 2 or 3 years ago, I remember the last tweet I saw was somebody saying that Jews in the eastern suburbs of Sydney ought to be fair game for violence because of Gaza, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, did that lead to what we saw in Bondi? It's impossible to draw that connection. But it seems like I for one, wouldn't mind if internet companies and the sort of internet bureaucracy, you know, the leaders like Elon Musk and so on, if they were forced to bring some of the speech there in line with the safety of the community. And I think that's a less interventionist approach, more of a positive kind of nurturing approach. Mm.
You do run into problems of definition around all these sorts. I mean, so the example you cited, that's fairly clear cut. There's always a question of where the border gets drawn and precisely how sharply and so on. But maybe that's a free speech show, which we've already done or we'll do again, or I don't know. But I want to begin by saying, Ron, that we've sounded very pessimistic about social cohesion, et cetera. I think we were pessimistic in describing the problem that government is saying it wants to solve.
Yes, that's right.
That's how I would say. I am a bit less sure about the state of our social cohesion to court. The reason I say that is, one, I'm not entirely sure what social cohesion means and how I would define it and measure it, but those who try, like the Scanlon Foundation, they keep saying, well, the figures show that we're no less cohesive than we were and that prejudice or whatever isn't really rising dramatically in ways that our rhetoric, political level insists. What we might be witnessing instead is just greater amplification at the extremes, so that our opposites are more at each other's throats than we've seen before. But that doesn't describe the state of the society broadly. Okay. Let's just assume that's a true description for the moment. I think there's probably a fair chance that that's true or true-ish. What we're then looking at is not so much a problem of social cohesion per se. We're looking at a problem of polarization at the margins of our society, even if those margins are slightly bigger than they used to be, in ways that manifest this incommensurability that we've been talking about and make the rest of Australia feel quite uncomfortable. Okay, so let's describe that. If that's the problem, then I'm interested in the Citizens' Assembly idea being constituted, as you described it, around non-partisans. Because it's not the non-partisans who are trying to seek the accommodation here or whose accommodation would make the social difference. The thing that would make the social difference would be some kind of deliberation amongst the partisans. I think that's right. Like, I think that's what flows logically from the scene I've described. And then if that deliberation, though, is foreclosed because that deliberation itself amounts to some kind of complicity or the level of incommensurability is such that even a common language would be too difficult to try to distill by which the deliberation could take place and so on. That's where I wonder about the work of something like Citizens Assembly. Like, I mean, I'm intrigued as to the possibilities of it and even accounting for scalability. But how do you see it crossing the divide that is inherently partisan if what it's focusing on are the non-partisan actors?
Yeah, so great question. Let me just start with the last point or one of the last points that you made, which is the need for a common language. I think that you're questioning whether there can be a common language among people who can't see the legitimacy of each other. So they don't understand each other's grievances, like Scott said. So I think that in practice, what we see is that these nonpartisans do find that language. And the language is in the language of values and principles like nonviolence and equality and inclusion and opportunity and things like that. These broad values tend to be ones on which you can agree. And so I've been working on peacemaking for the past 10 years or so. So places like Northern Ireland, Bosnia, by working, I mean researching, what happened there. Even in a place like Northern Ireland, you saw the two sides or the multiple sides actually agree on a number of values. And that was something that preceded the referendum that was held in 1998. So if they can do it, I think that we can do it here. And I mentioned earlier that even Israelis and Palestinians have been put together in citizens' assemblies and they can agree. However, I think you're right, Waleed, that there's still the question of what we call the scale-up. You know, how do you go from a mini-public to the macro-public? How can you ensure that a mini-public will actually take its lessons and its wonderful ideal of deliberation and actually influence the rest of the society? Mm-hmm. And the short answer is that you can't. You can't guarantee it. But mini-publics tend to be highly trusted, and I think that's an important point because they draw on two kinds of sort of trust. One is democratic kind of legitimacy. Because you've got ordinary citizens, other citizens actually think that they're just like them, and so they feel, I can trust these people, they're not insiders. And then, to some extent, insiders, the actual insiders, the elites, also, they might not actually trust the mini-public as much, and we have studies that show that they don't trust them as much, but they have to show some fealty to them, right? Like, they can't just ignore what this sort of democratic cross-section of the society has said, because that would be impolitic. And so to some extent, there's that trust connection between the mini-public and the macro-public, but it might fall apart. So in some examples, it hasn't worked. So for example, in Ontario in 2007, there was a concerted effort by one side of politics to sort of badmouth the mini-public that was being held there on electoral reform. And that worked. If you get somebody who is determined to undermine the public trust in a mini-public, you can do it. But
you cast them themselves as elites or partisans or some such.
Yeah, you can say, look, who are these people? Why do they get to decide for you? Exactly. They're now the elite insiders.
Yes. And who were the experts that they were exposed to and who decided that and all those,
Well, so is there a solution? I think there are a couple of solutions, possibly. One is that you get the many publics to do certain things, like, for example, write information. This is a great missed opportunity during the Voice referendum campaign. Instead of having parliamentarians who are obviously deeply partisan write the yes and no pamphlet, why not have nonpartisan people who are highly informed? That's an important thing about a mini public or citizens assembly, that they've actually spoken to experts, that they've learned from them at length. And so most people do actually trust that mini publics are well informed and also democratically represented. So you can get them to do specific things like that, like disseminate information, which people will trust a lot more than parliamentarians speaking to them. But then the other thing is that you can actually sometimes do things in a binding way. So I just happened to be looking at Bosnia and, you know, the war there, it ended around, you know, in the 1990s, and then in the late 1990s, they didn't have a mini public, but they had an inclusive commission to rewrite the laws for a district called Brčko. And it's kind of a mini public in some ways. And one of the reasons why it really worked was that it was binding. You couldn't just ignore it. And that's really controversial. Is it the kind of democracy that we want to tie our system to, the sort of randomly selected or appointed, you know, representative body? You know, I don't think that I have all the answers on that. I think that, you know, we have to keep thinking that through, whether it's acceptable to have a mini public or something like it bind. But that's a way of making sure that their influence is significant and real. Mm.
You are listening to The Minefield on ABC Radio National. That voice that you heard belongs to Ron Levy, who's a professor in the College of Law, Governance and Policy at the Australian National University. Willie Dowley is my name. Scott Stevens is my co-host. Scott.
I guess, Ron, I'm not quite so interested, and this may just be a failure of imagination on my part. It really might be. I'm not quite so interested in the idea of scalability. I'm really quite intrigued, though, about the possibility of deliberative bodies being selected and being entrusted with tasks that require a degree of finesse, of sensitivity, that aren't easily reduced to sort of partisan or political contestation, and things around which there really might be some potential if we can get away from, you know, mutually or competing polemics, around which there really could be something like a degree of mutual understanding. I mean, one of the things that I'm quite intrigued by is your suggestion, your interest in maybe these sort of deliberative bodies, these citizens' assemblies being used as a kind of adjudicating mechanism to determine when speech or what speech crosses boundaries from protest into hate speech. Now, just cards on the table, I'm far more amenable to the criminalization of certain forms of speech than perhaps others are, other guests. I don't want to speak for Waleed here. I have deep, deep, deep concerns about the environmental, the social and environmental effects of the normalization of certain forms of speech and the degree to which that can lead to a kind of prevailing condition of contempt, of alienation, and then ultimately a sort of open season within which, you know, sort of certain citizens almost breathe kind of toxic or infected air. They can't find their place. They can't sort of feel themselves at home with their fellow citizens. But there are those things that are said in the context of protests that might be found extremely offensive, even borderline violent by some, which may not necessarily cross that threshold. And having a group of persons who can speak with one another and explain themselves, that's not the right word, but who can in fact deliberate in good faith over issues where there really could be nuance, where there really could be subtleties that are simply being missed in the conduct of public debate more generally. There's something there, I think, that could be really productive, a way of cutting a knot that we can't seem to quite get ourselves out of.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I think that, you know, when it comes to free speech or political communication, as we call it in Australia, that's what's constitutionally protected. I think there's a common misconception about it, which is that it's absolute. And so you see this very often in these zero-sum debates about protest, for example. I think Matt Canavan, for one, has recently said that, you know, well, you obviously can't ban any protest because free speech. But that's not how it works. So The political communication framework is one of balancing. So, and all speech basically is about balancing. All speech regulation is about balancing. Balancing between the government's public objective, which, you know, you'd have to define it really well, but it's something about protecting vulnerable groups, maybe social cohesion, or just protecting against violence downstream of speech. So if those are the objectives, you can see why it is that free speech is not absolute. Those are all very potentially positive objectives. So what we do in a balancing exercise in the courts, for example, is first of all, we ask whether the law is actually going to achieve anything. Will it actually achieve its purposes? And then we ask, you know, will the law or can another law have achieved this purpose with less restrictive effect on speech? But then ultimately it comes down to just balancing, you know, the importance of the free speech protection against the importance of the governmental purpose. And so that's what we do. We do that in law all the time. And so just to give one example, there was a protest. There's a law against protests against abortion clinics in Tasmania and also in Victoria. And the High Court of Australia said that that law, keeping anti-abortion protesters beyond 150 meters, was acceptable. That was it was constitutional. So that's just an example of how free speech can be upheld. So, and one of the things that the court said was that we have to protect women who are seeking to, you know, have this procedure because we need to protect their privacy and their medical sort of integrity and their dignity. So you can imagine that similar issues come up when it comes to protecting vulnerable groups. So some people talk about the ecology of hatred. So for example, you can say a whole lot of things on Twitter or what have you, and you might not be immediately advocating violence. It's not an immediate incitement to violence, but it might create the conditions for it. And so this is a bit of an extreme analogy, but going back to Bosnia, the war didn't start with a call to arms. It started with exactly that from people like Slobodan Milosevic. That's not going to happen here in the future in Australia, but there are always some people who are susceptible to calls to violence. And so, you know, creating an ecology for particular groups to be more vulnerable and to be targeted with hate and ultimately maybe violence down the line is something that, you know, I agree with you, Scott. I don't think we should exclude that out of hand. I think sometimes that could be a useful thing to do, to regulate that kind of thing. And so what we have then ultimately is a situation where we have to balance two good interests against each other, free speech versus the protection of minorities. And ultimately, you know, I think the big misconception has been that only one of these things matters. They both matter, and we can only do that balancing analysis on a case-by-case basis. You can't do it once and for all. This is why I've suggested in some writing with Selene Erkan and John Dryzek that the Royal Commission on Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion can't really solve the problem. It can only perhaps set up a process to solve a problem down the line. And that process, you know, I agree, could be something inclusive where we overcome these sort of gaps in groups' understanding of each other. And this is something that goes back to ancient times. It's an acknowledgement that we judge others very poorly and ourselves very positively. We, according to Aesop, for example, we have a bag in front and a bag behind us. And in the bag in front of us, we put all of our neighbor's faults. In the bag behind, the one that we can't see, we put our own. And so that's precisely what we see in the modern day on questions like the ones that you've raised, like Australia Day, Israel-Palestine, and so on. People are simply not looking at the other side with any sort of respect for what they're saying. And so a respectful, deliberative process in which people from multiple groups are brought together to talk in a civil way, it's been done thousands of times around the world. It can be done in this sort of situation as well.
Can I mention something? It doesn't quite count as a deliberative body, but it was pretty damn close. I was part of a consultation, a convocation that was held by an Australian university that brought together representatives of not just leaders, but representatives of the Australian Muslim community and a number of senior editors, journalists. This was during a time of ill-judged headlines, poor and inflammatory reporting, really problematic representation of Australian Muslims in newspapers, on news sites. And it was held ostensibly as a way of kind of working out a policy document that was going to provide editorial best practice. This is how better to do headlines that don't inflame or that don't prejudice. These are considerations around the images that are selected and used. The particular table that I was at, there was a woman who I know very well, and there were a number of journalists who I know quite well. And at one point of this particular conversation, this woman looked directly across at a senior journalist and said, "On this date, you wrote this piece with this headline and this picture. That afternoon, this is what happened to my daughter. This is what was said to her on the way home from school." There was something, there's a category in moral philosophy that's sometimes called moral encounter, where someone is confronted by the moral reality of another person. And suddenly various forms of manner and political alignment and alibi and forms of self-defense and protection of ego fall away. That's what I watched happen at that table. It was the kind of moral encounter I cannot imagine it happening really in any other context. And I can't imagine the expression of remorse, of recognition, of moral recognition, that what was a kind of expression of journalistic flair would have that effect on this person. Even if the direct causal link wasn't necessarily established, the recognition of a kind of the consequences of what one does when one's responsibilities for the conditions of our common life aren't front of mind. I guess this is something, I don't mean to be kind of too mushy or romantic about it, but it's the possibility for that kind of moral encounter, the recognition of the moral reality of our fellow citizens, of groups that are with whom we share this common life and with whom we bear a common burden. There's something along those lines that I'm hoping, I guess, that these sorts of assemblies, even if they aren't scalable, could at least provoke, and those forms of then democratic or moral transformation then could follow.
I think that's a great story. And, you know, it fits something that we see, you know, around the world in many publics. For example, there is a professor named Juan Ugariza in Colombia who interviewed a number of people from communities affected by the conflict there. And he did a number of very, very sophisticated studies. And he showed that in part, there's a cognitive sort of intellectual process that leads groups in a mini public to come together and sort of understand each other. But it's also largely an effective process. It's about sharing emotion and walking in each other's shoes and things like that. And that effective process is what actually leads to common ground. And so this is why ordinary people are actually really good at this kind of thing. You don't need to be a moral philosopher. You don't need to be trained academically. You just can talk with another person and learn from their points of view. And once you do that, it's time and time again, it's thousands of times around the world, including in conflict areas, people are much more receptive to each other's points of view.
I'm almost hopeful. This is quite an achievement, Ron. Well done. We are out of time, alas, but thank you so much for... I don't think we've ever tackled this topic head on in quite the way we have here. So, thank you very much for your help. It's been immensely valuable.
Thank you.
Ron Levy, Professor in the College of Law, Governance and Policy at the Australian National University. This episode of The Mindfield is now at an end. You can catch us next week on ABC Radio National, of course, but you can listen to us anytime you like on ABC Listen. See you soon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.